Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Kara Dansky and Natasha Chart. Kara Dansky is a radical feminist and an attorney. She joined the Women's Liberation Front in 2015 and has been on the board since 2016. Kara contributes to all of Wolf's legal advocacy. Natasha Chart is the chair of the board of directors of Wolf. She's also been on the board since 2016. So, first off, thank you for your work on the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
So there is an upcoming Supreme Court case with which you have some involvement. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the case is called R.G. and G.R. Harris versus EEOC and Stevens. And essentially what happened in this case is Stevens is a man, and he worked at a funeral home called Harris in Michigan. And one day he shared with his employer that he wanted to quote unquote live his life as a woman. The implications of this for employment were that the Harris funeral home had in place a sex specific dress code that required male employees to wear pants and female employees to wear skirts. And Stevens, who now goes by the name of Amy, demanded the right to be recognized quote unquote as a woman and to wear the skirt that female employees were required to wear, and went to the EEOC, which sued the funeral home on his behalf and won, and the case has made it up to the Supreme Court. And Wolf has filed an amicus brief, which is fancy for friend of the court brief, in the case, essentially presenting the argument that sex is grounded in material reality. Gender identity ideology is simply that, an ideology, and that for Title VII purposes, we want to interpret the word sex to mean sex, which is exactly what Congress intended when it enacted Title VII of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and that interpreting the word sex to mean gender identity for purposes of interpreting the nation's Civil Rights Act would be an unmitigated disaster for women and girls. Additionally, we take the opportunity to make the argument that sex stereotyping in employment is already unlawful under established Supreme Court precedent. So that's already true. There was an old case where a woman was treated unfavorably, at least in part, because she was female, and the court ruled that that's illegal in the employment context. And we wanted to make that point because we really do mean sex when we talk about sex stereotyping or sex discrimination. So we filed our brief. There are dozens of amicus briefs that have been filed in this case on both sides, and the case goes to oral argument on October 8th, and we're looking forward to it.
So before we go on, you know, I've heard of Title IX having to do with sports. I don't know what Title VII is. Can you tell us about that?
Title VII prohibits discrimination in the employment arena, and it covers race, national origin, sex, and religion. I should say I'm not a Title VII expert, but I believe those are the categories that it covers, and it's part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it's, you know, landmark legislation that, and we know what Congress meant when Congress used the word sex in Title VII, but essentially it prohibits discrimination in the employment context on the basis of those categories.
So for example, this would have been the argument that a female pilot would have made in 1974, in order to become a pilot for, TWA or Frontier or United, as opposed to males trying to hold as opposed to only males being allowed to be pilots. I'm making this up. So
yes, that's right.
But that's how it has been used.
That is the law that such a female pilot would use to sue the airline. Yes.
So before we go on, can you give me some of the arguments from the different primary perspectives? I mean, you said there's many amicus briefs have been filed. You don't have to tell me every single one, but can you give me some of the main arguments from the other sides? And the other sides, including those who may be on the same side as you on this case, but are arguing different ideas.
So there are some conservative organizations that have filed on the same side present some religious objections to the notion that a person can change sex. There is a brief that was filed by the Independent Women's Forum, which makes the point that it's really important to preserve sex-based protections in the business context. There is an amicus brief filed on our side by a group that wants to promote sex-segregated sports teams. I don't know how much you follow that, but that's become a really big issue. So there are a lot of people on our side in this case who are coming at this issue through different lenses, and frankly, with whom Wolf has some very strong and fundamental disagreements on other issues. The main issues on the other side, the main issues in support, or the arguments in support of Stevens, is that gender identity has some scientific grounding, and that Title VII, the employment discrimination, anti-discrimination law, should be reinterpreted such that sex would mean gender identity under the law. That's essentially what they all boil down to.
And they've said, like, in the ACLU brief on behalf of Stevens, and I should note that a lot of times when you see this case shortened in popular media context and the way that we've been talking about it, it's usually called the Harris case. So if people talk about the Harris case, that's what this is. The ACLU and others have argued that this is discrimination on the basis of transgender identity. And they've put that as if it's, you know, a discrete and identifiable class, whereas none of their briefs have defined transgender identity as something that has a consistent legal meaning. But then when they talk about it in public, they've talked about it as though this is a case about sex-based dress codes, and as if they wanted to, in this filing, as if Stevens wanted to strike down sex-based dress codes. But that's not what he's arguing. He's arguing that he needs to be recognized as a woman in order to be allowed to follow the women's sex-based dress codes.
So wait. Sorry to interrupt. So to be clear, oftentimes when people on the other side of this argument are presenting it, they are presenting it as though Stevens is attempting to destroy requirements based on the requirement that women must wear dresses or that men
Yeah.
must wear pants. But in actuality, that's not what he's claiming. He's claiming that he is a woman and therefore must follow the women's dress code. Am I seeing this correctly?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. He could have said, I want to wear a skirt to work because in my private life, I think of myself as a woman. Whatever we may think of that.
He could do it because he says he wants to wear skirts because he likes it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter the reason.
And he could have challenged the funeral home's sex-based dress code on that basis, and he chose not to. So the question of what the word sex means is squarely before the United States Supreme Court.
Which is the nub of this matter.
Yes.
So,
and we've...
Go ahead, please.
Just, we've also argued in our brief that this constitutes unlawful compelled speech. Which is very important to me. I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness, and Jehovah's Witnesses, as some folks may know, do not salute the flag or sing the national anthem. And years ago, a Jehovah's Witness had to go to court in order to get the Supreme Court to affirm that even though, you know, patriotism is very important to many citizens of the United States, and even though it's very important to the government and school system to encourage this, that you're not allowed to make someone do that. You can't make someone salute the flag. You can't make someone sing the national anthem. And so this was an idea that the government can't make you say things you don't agree with. That I have grown up believing is like one of my foundational constitutional rights all my life. in spite of the fact that I'm no longer a member of that church. But, you know, everybody in their briefs, including the plaintiff's briefs, everybody agrees that Amy Stevens is a man, that he is male at any rate, even if they say that he can be a woman anyway, they agree that he's male. And so they're asking for the right not only to compel speech, but to compel speech that they know to be false, which is just extraordinary to me. It's unbelievable. And I can't even imagine that this country would change so much that a country that has affirmed for decades that you have the right not to participate in, you know, our nationalistic patriotic rituals would then say, oh, but we can force you under penalty of law to say something that everybody knows isn't true.
You can force us to say things we know aren't true, and further, you can force us to believe things that we know aren't true. That's essentially what Stevens is arguing here.
So, Stevens himself would not argue, would he, that he is trying to get you to believe something that is not true. Stevens himself would argue, okay, I'm making this up, and correct me, and interrupt me and correct me when I'm wrong. Stevens himself would argue that your notion of what constitutes female is outdated and has been superseded by a postmodern notion of what, help me out here.
I would say that Stevens himself definitely is asking the court to order Harris to believe and say something that Harris does not believe to be true. As a broader matter, this entire movement is absolutely based on the idea that those of us who think that sex is grounded in material reality, as you say, are outdated, and that biology has been superseded by this ideology. So, you know, we don't really need to quarrel too much about whether Stevens wants, for example, you, Derek, to believe that he is a woman. But he is absolutely asking the court to force Harris to both believe and act as though they believe that Stevens is a woman.
But, okay, and I hear this, and I want to come back to the case in a minute, but the truth is that this ideology, this particular case is very important, but this ideology, there are people who are losing their jobs. I have been deplatformed. One of the times I was deplatformed, as I was walking out on stage, one of the people who was attempting to deplatform me, she had one and only question for me. She said, "Do you believe trans women are women?" And when I would not pledge that allegiance, then she went full force ahead to try to deplatform me. That was the only, so my point is, this is not just Harris trying to force the funeral home to do this. This is happening around the world as people are losing their jobs. I've lost publishers over this. Anybody who disagrees with his ideology is blacklisted.
Yes.
Yeah, people have been fired, harassed, stalked, deplatformed, threatened. I know a woman.
I can't tell you how many death threats I've received. Go ahead, please.
Well, you know. No, but I know a woman who had to move out of town. I know another woman who was fired quite recently from a very liberal organization, and for legal reasons that cannot be discussed, but it's an ongoing immolation of the careers of everyone who stands up and refuses to say something that everyone knows isn't true. Like, if you will not lie, you will have people attempt to destroy your life, and they may very well succeed.
And they have, in many instances.
So I mean, they've done it to me, so.
So I want to go back to this. I mean, I have like a two-part interrogation here. And step one is, would you agree that law requires definition of terms? Clear definition of terms. Such that if I get a parking ticket and they say, you get a parking ticket because you parked in a no parking zone, but the county or city or whoever takes care of the parking has not defined what is a no parking zone, then they can't give me a ticket essentially, right? I mean, that you have to define what a no parking zone is. If you're going to arrest somebody for murder, you have to have a definition of murder. If you're going to arrest somebody for not paying taxes, you have to have a definition of what taxes are. Is this all correct so far in understanding how the legal system needs definitions?
Absolutely. And, you know, as I think we all know, on some level, it's absurd that you're even asking that question, right? I mean, of course the law needs definition. The law consists of words that mean things. And you're absolutely right that governments have an obligation to define the terms of the law if they are going to expect the people to abide by it. How can we abide by laws that we don't understand? Or that, not that we don't understand, but that nobody is capable of understanding.
So you know where I'm going with this, right? The next question is, how does the other side legally define woman?
Anyone who identifies as a woman.
Okay.
I should say that's typically, I should take that back. I'll walk it back a little bit. I'm not aware of any of the briefs that explicitly argue that. That is typically the argument that is put forth in conversations about this issue generally in society. Or it's either anyone who identifies as a woman, or more typically in legal cases, it's anyone whose quote unquote gender identity does not align with their quote unquote sex assigned at birth.
Okay.
But these terms are always, the goalposts move constantly. So feminists working on this issue for a long time were told, oh no, sex and gender aren't the same thing. I was born male, but now I'm a woman. But then the goalposts changed, and feminists working on this issue started receiving the message that, oh no, I am a woman because I say I'm a woman, and what that means is I am female. So it's been very challenging to figure out how to address all these issues because the goalposts keep changing. And what we keep relentlessly saying over and over again is that women are female and men are male. And this really is not complicated.
And how would an attorney for the other side be able to hold their head up if their definition is based on a tautology? I mean, saying that a woman is anybody who identifies as a woman is the same thing as saying a square is anything we call a square. It's meaningless. We learned this in literally fifth grade when they taught you how definitions work. The definition cannot be tautological, and it must be verifiable/falsifiable. And for those who don't know, tautology simply means using a word to define itself. You can't say a woman is somebody who identifies as a woman any more than you can say a dog is somebody I call a dog. That's not how definitions work. And this is one of the things that has driven me crazy about this ideology. I don't understand how they can write about it in the New York Times and they can have it before the Supreme Court when this should have all been stopped in fifth grade.
So my answer is going to be really unsatisfying, and I want to hear what Natasha has to say, but my very unsatisfying response is that I am similarly mystified, especially when we have the federal judiciary engaging in it, because these conversations happen in society, and as we all know, our society has been really dumbed down by postmodern theory, and it's also possible for me to understand why our elected officials push this ideology because they receive campaign money. So I understand why elected people will go along with this, but the United States federal judiciary consists of a bunch of women and men who were appointed for lifetime terms. And I can conceive of no good or sensible reason for the courts to be saying the kinds of things that they're saying in established precedent, including in another case that Wolf filed an amicus brief in, a sitting judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia, a judge that I have met and until recently had a tremendous amount of respect for, literally said to an attorney, you are not permitted to use the words biological sex. Sorry, you are not allowed to use the words opposite sex because those words are confusing to me.
Does he have children?
I know. Yes, he does.
So I don't think it's that confusing.
Yeah, there was another lower court that I remember reading one of the decisions, and I think it was the Gavin Grimm case that used the term so-called biological sex. But, like, this is a direct quote from the ACLU's brief in the Harris case, and it's not, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense out of context, but I want to get one narrow little point out of it. So here's what they say. But here, Harris Holmes did not simply notice that Ms. Stevens was assigned male at birth. It fired her because of her assigned sex. And so this is like a brief on behalf of the plaintiff that is talking about how this is a male person. Like, it's just right there in the, they're not even arguing that this person is not male. So, I mean, it just kind of blows me away. They're asking the government to define a woman as, well, maybe a male person. Maybe an adult human male is a woman.
Under what circumstances?
Under the circumstances that he says so. That he says he is transgender and then he fits into this completely new category of being a transgender person.
So another part of a definition is that it not only cannot be tautological, but it must be verifiable / falsifiable. So if I say to you, if I hand you a triangle and I say that's a square, you can say, no, that's not a square because squares have four sides, four equidistant sides, blah, blah, blah. So it's falsifiable. I can say, I am a vegan. You can say, what did you have for dinner last night? I say, I had some bacon. And then you say, no, that means you're not a vegan because a vegan has a definition. So, and it's falsifiable. So.
But what if we want to queer the definition of vegan, Derek? What if I'm a trans vegan, even though I am a bacon lover? And I am. But
when you do this, you are destroying the foundation of law.
Yes.
The foundation of law is verifiable definitions. Because, I mean, that's the thing. I'm driving down the road at 80 miles an hour, a cop stops me, and then I go to court and I say, no, I wasn't driving 80, I was driving 40, and he shows the radio thing the radar thing that says I was going 80, and it's like, oops, I lose. I mean, that's called evidence. I'm sorry that my voice is getting thin and reedy, but this is just so stupid.
It is. And part of the reason that Natasha and I are even able to talk about this calmly is that we talk about it all the time, and we're so used to the utter absurdity of what is being put forth by the other side that it's become, I mean, I can't speak for Natasha, but it's just become commonplace for me to sit here and just wonder why on earth anyone is accepting it. And it is profoundly disturbing to me, especially that the federal judiciary is going along with this.
Yeah. So go ahead, please.
It's kind of hard to, I mean, to believe that I, as a grown person, am having to explain to other grown people what sex is. Like, they're little children who need, you know, basic sex ed classes, or like they never took biology in school at all, or they don't know how babies are made. I mean, I've been shunned over this by women who have had children, who have had very, you know, painful and debilitating female specific medical conditions that none of these men who say that they're women will ever get because they can't. They just can't. And that's nobody's fault. It's a completely neutral fact. You know, if you're a man, if you're a woman, it just happened that way and nobody can do anything about that. What we decide to do about that is different, but it's funny and strange and infuriating. And yeah, I sometimes feel like it's going over stuff that people should have learned in fourth grade, that now the trans activists are saying, oh, well, that fourth grade biology, like, I don't know, people figured out how babies were made, like, before we had language. Animals who can't even talk understand what sex is. Every mammal understands what sex is. It's not, you don't need to be a rocket scientist. It's simple.
Sorry, having been a scientist myself, I'm sure that there are many who are not rocket scientists who have more sex than rocket scientists do. but leaving that aside, so there's a few directions we can go. One of them is, can you talk about the larger, I'm gonna lay about a buffet here and you can choose whatever you want. So one option is to talk about the larger social implications of men identifying themselves into women. What does this mean for women's sports, women's jail, women's shelters, women in general? That's one possibility. Another possibility is to speak more specifically about the case itself, and your own Supreme Court brief, and the importance and what your hope is, what your fear is. Third possibility is, did it feel weird at all to be filing briefs on a case where you disagree with some of the other defendants? Or is that just standard politics? Those are three possible directions. And if I had a choice, it would be the larger implications, but it's your interview. So take whatever you want.
Natasha, what do you think?
Gosh, well, I mean, you know, we can try to get to as much of that as we can, but to the last one, I would just say, you know, if you want to hear a political position from someone, from like someone running for office or someone running an organization that you're going to agree with all the time, then you should do it yourself. You should run for office yourself if you want to agree with everything that comes out of a politician's mouth. Like this is a democratic country. We have decided that we are going to make our decisions collectively, and there are just always going to be a lot of people out there who disagree with us. And sometimes they're going to agree with us about one thing and disagree about 20 other things. And there's nothing that we can do about that that's not authoritarian, except figure out how to work together in civil society. And so that's what I'd say to that. But I would agree that the larger implications of this for society, I mean, that's a really important question, because this isn't, you know, as we say in our brief, this is not going to just stay in Title VII employment law. If the government finds, if the Supreme Court finds that it violates a man's civil rights to understand that he is a male person and to understand that there's no, and to do so without qualification, like, it's not being argued that Stevens has some kind of, that it's because of the basis of a medical condition. You know, they talk about gender dysphoria, but they don't ask for gender dysphoria to even be a test. So, like, they bring it up, but it's not germane to what they want. They want total self-identification. I am a woman because I say I am a woman. And so there's no end to the implications of that in terms of, you know, like the man who is sitting in prison right now, who calls himself Michelle Kozelek, for strangling his wife to death, and dumping her body in a car park and lying about it. I mean, that guy wants a sex change on the state, and then he wants to transfer to a women's prison, it seems, from all the briefs and information that I've read about that. Massachusetts DOC have argued that the women in the Framingham institution there are terrified of the idea that someone that violent to women could be put in their institution with him. You know, and it's a women's prison. Like, women's prisons are not maximum security facilities, because female prisoners in general are not very dangerous. They're often minimum security facilities. And these guys will usually go in there and argue that, well, if you segregate them away from the other prisoners, well, that's a violation of their human rights too. So you want to put this guy who's like strangled his wife into the general population of the Massachusetts women's prison system. I mean, that is, are you violating his civil rights if you do not do that? Do we think that Michelle Kozelek, who strangled his wife to death, that it's his civil right to demand cosmetic genital surgery and a place in a women's prison with like terrified low-income single mothers who are probably mainly in there on petty drug charges, who are probably mostly victims of domestic violence themselves? Whose civil rights are we caring about there? So this is just that there's no wall to where this will stop.
Especially if, yes, if the Supreme Court decides in favor of Stevens, it's a disaster for women and girls. And Natasha's completely right that if sex means gender identity under Title VII, there's no logical reason not to extend it, not to extend that definition to elsewhere in law. The only other thing I would say about the case itself, because our brief is fairly straightforward. We argue that sex is grounded in material reality, that women are female and men are male, that a holding in favor of Stevens would have vast implications for women and girls across the country in all sorts of arenas. It would also have implications just for society, which I think we're going into that. And then we make the coerced speech argument. The only other thing that I would say is that some of your listeners may know that Harris is often talked about in connection with two other cases, which are fundamentally gay rights cases. Both cases involved men who were openly gay and were fired, and they claim that they were fired as a result of their being openly gay. And the three cases are often talked about in the media in tandem. I would argue they are fundamentally different cases. Wolf absolutely supports the rights of gay people not to be discriminated against in employment, and we make that point in our brief specifically by relying on the argument around sex stereotyping. And we make the argument that assumed heterosexuality is in and of itself a form of sex stereotyping. And so if an employer fires a gay employee, that is a form of sex stereotyping, which would be illegal under current case law. So I just wanted to make that point. To the extent that anyone is linking the Stevens case with these two other gay rights cases, it's actually very important to separate them, because the gay rights cases truly are legitimate complaints about discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. The Stevens case is fundamentally not about that.
So to be clear, you you are arguing that a little boy who likes to play with dolls and who likes to dance to Barry Manilow music should, that doesn't make that little boy a little girl. It makes that little boy someone who should be loved as a little boy who loves to dance and loves to play with dolls, and a little girl who likes to play with trucks and who likes to fix bicycles and later cars, that doesn't make her a little boy. That makes her a little girl who should be loved for being a little girl who loves to play with trucks and play football and to work with cars. Is that your position?
And further, if that little girl grows up to be attracted to girls, she should absolutely be able to do that. It doesn't make her a straight man. It makes her a lesbian. And that little boy, if he grows up to be attracted to other boys, is not a straight woman. He's a gay man. And that should be fine.
And she should be allowed to wear coveralls if she wants.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sorry to even have to make
20
this.
20 or 30 years ago. It was like, yeah, a little girl wearing coveralls. You go. What's the big deal? I wore clothes like that when I was a little girl. I did not wear like all lacy frilly dresses and stuff, and my family were like very hardline Christian conservatives. I feel like I had less sex stereotyping in the clothes that I had to wear or had available to wear as a kid. You know, I'd wear dresses to church, but a lot of times I was wearing pants and no one thought, oh, well, that made me a boy. It's just so weird. It feels very regressive, like we've gone back to where my childhood in the 70s sounds like some, you know, utopian, less gendered paradise. Like, and it was not at all. But clothes-wise, why should kids think that that affects your sex? It's really weird. Why are their parents going along with that?
Let's go back to a few more of the implications. I'll just throw a couple out to, and you can tell me if these are wrong. There are schools now where girls are disallowed from changing in, where a boy who says that he is a girl can now go into the girls' locker room, and the girls have been said by courts to not have a right to visual privacy in that locker room. And so if there's a male who identifies as a girl in that room, she's basically tough luck for her. That's correct, is it not?
It is correct. What the courts have generally said, or what the schools have generally said, is when a trans-identified person wants to be able to access the facilities of the opposite sex, that should be okay on the basis of gender identity. And when girls push back and say, well, you know, that's not so okay for us, but maybe this boy who identifies as a girl could use a third facility. Those girls have been told, well, you're being really discriminatory against this trans person. So actually what we're going to do is we're going to have facilities based on gender identity. And if any student is concerned with privacy, visual privacy or otherwise, that student can use a third facility.
And so I'm sorry if I'm kind of slow to this party, but what this is all attempting to do, this coup that's going on, is an attempt to substitute an I'm not even going to say ill-defined, but an indefinable gender identity for sex.
Yes, absolutely. And it's particular, so this has tremendous implications, and we can talk about all of them, but it's just worth maybe making the point, because Natasha and I do both represent a feminist organization. It is utterly infuriating to know that women have been discriminated against, violated, beaten, murdered, held out of society, and kept in the home for thousands of years on the basis of our biology. And all of a sudden, or within the last several years, a man can put on a dress and claim to be marginalized. It's utterly infuriating.
Yeah. I mean, there were no men threatening to kill themselves if they couldn't be, you know, classified by the government as someone who was not allowed to vote or own property. Where was that? Where was that in the historical record? Because people sure talked about that. I mean, sexology, you know, for all the issues with that as a discipline, people who are interested in a systematic study of human sexual behavior has been around for a long time, and people have been talking about all of this for a long time. Where is the record of those men swearing that they are nigh unsuicidal if they cannot have their voting rights taken away because they're really a woman, that the government is oppressing them by giving them the franchise as if they were male? Where is that? Like, find that in the historical record, please. Drives me insane.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I have stammered more in this interview than I think I have in any other interview, because I think I started falling apart when I read a sentence in the New York Times where it said, it was talking about some male identifies as transgender, and it talked about her penis.
Oh God.
And I don't really know, not even the dogs like it.
Right.
They don't even understand it. They're going, why did you do that? And so take that. We have like 5 minutes left. Go. I'm just sitting here stammering at the complete Alice in Wonderland nature of all this. I'm throwing myself at your mercy and just do whatever you want.
Okay. I'd like to take a few minutes and just be a little self-promotional, not literally for myself, but for Wolf, and just say that Wolf Women's Liberation Front is literally the only women's organization that is before all three branches of government advancing explicitly radical feminist arguments, and we're making some headway. So for example, I had the opportunity to meet with some fairly high up officials at the Department of Education, and I said to this man, I looked him right in the eye and I said to him, women have been fighting for women-only spaces in the public realm for a very long time, and we won them, and that was a feminist victory. Before we had public women's rooms, there was no such thing as women's rooms. There were only public restrooms, and women were terrified to go into them because we have every legitimate right to fear males in enclosed spaces. So we fought for our right to women-only space in the public sphere, and that was a crucial piece of helping women get out of the home and helping women participate actively in civil society in all the ways that we have been able to. We won the right to serve on juries because of feminists. We won the right to vote, as Natasha said. These are all feminist fights, and Wolf is the only organization that is advancing feminist arguments before all three branches of the United States government at this time, and that is something of which I am quite proud.
And let me add to that, to bring it back to what you were saying, Derek, about the her penis issue, if there is such a thing as her penis, why can she not undress in the locker room with all the other women? Or, you know, clean herself up and change in the restroom? Like, this is the way that they talk about these things at the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center and all of these other, you know, NGOs that are not, they're not explicitly trans rights or LGBT rights, but they support these issues. They say, well, but this is a girl's body. How dare you talk, when we're talking about locker room privacy in schools, how dare you talk about a young girl's body like this? But it's a boy's body. And all of this language is disappearing the right of women to name male voyeurism, particularly as a problem that we face as a form of harassment that used to keep us out of the public sphere and, you know, sort of sexualized indecent exposure meant to threaten and coerce women. I mean, we're the only feminist organization in the U.S. who's arguing that if you are a male and you pull down your pants in the women's locker room, this should still be considered sexual harassment, even if you're not on public transportation. You know, the whole gender identity policy means you can say that's sexual harassment if you're on the subway, if you're on the bus, but as soon as he goes into a woman's room and says it's her penis, he can drop his pants and show it to whoever he wants. And it's not a crime, and you're violating his civil rights to complain about it. That's where we're going. That's what we're seeing with the Canadian waxing cases, where that Yanov character has taken women before the Human Rights Tribunal for refusing to give him the same kind of genital waxing procedures that they would give to a woman. If it's her penis, if he's legally female and must be recognized as such by all parties, she has to touch him. And this is just, if this becomes law, I can't even imagine how many decades it will take to undo. And I don't want to spend that many decades continuing to explain to other grown adults how babies are made, because that just seems like a terrible way to spend the remaining decades of one's life, I think. So I hope everybody wises up.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I want to read a couple quotes from 1984, and then we have like 1 or 2 minutes left. I'm going to do the quotes, and then you can respond however you want. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. Also, the Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war, the Ministry of Truth with lies, the Ministry of Love with torture, and the Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental, nor do they result from ordinary hypocrisy. They are deliberate examples in doublethink. Doublethink means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. And then I want to say that there's a way out of this madness presented in 1984, which is being in a minority, even in a minority of one, did not make you mad. There was truth and there was untruth. And if you clung to the truth, even against the world, you were not mad. So take this wherever you want and Godspeed on your journey here.
I think we're there. We're undeniably almost there if we're not there already. I talk with some women in the birthing community, the midwifery and doula communities, and all of their language is being destroyed as well. They're not allowed to talk about pregnant women. They're not allowed to talk about breastfeeding. Their licenses get threatened if they insist that women are female. And these are people whose job it is to help women deliver the babies. And their communities are being destroyed. So I don't think we're very far off at all from what you read, Derek.
My favorite part in that book, favorite as in horrifying and memorable and, you know, has been seared into my brain all these decades since I read it, is the part where Winston is threatened and he says, do it to Julia, who is, you know, the woman that he has come to love. And he has, in this torture chamber, he has decided that it doesn't matter what's true anymore. It, all these things that he cared about, his society of one, all of his resistance was nothing. And even love, that most fundamental human emotion, torture her instead. And that was when they broke him. And I see so many of my former colleagues in progressive politics who have become broken in that way. Seeing other people, you know, have their careers, their lives, their friendship circles just smashed by this. And their reaction to that has not been to stand up and say, hey, that's wrong, you can't do that. Their reaction has been to say, oh yes, please do it to her. Please do it to her, not me. I'm one of the good ones. I'll say you're a woman. I'm not mean. I'm not like that. I don't deserve that. Do it to her. And one of the most horrifying things about this has been realizing how many broken Winstons there are running the progressive movement in this country. And I used to consider a lot of these people my friends, my colleagues, some of them like second family. And, you know, what did they say when they came for me? Do it to her. Do it to Natasha. And if people out there don't understand that the left is really all in with this, they need to understand that. I just can't express how terrifying it has been to watch women who considered themselves like ardent feminists to the point where they'd make trouble for themselves at work start to say things like, oh, well, not all penises rape. It's turned it a lot of the left into an MRA movement, except they don't have to call themselves that. And it's been a tragedy in real life of unimaginable proportions.
So we're just about out of time. Is there anything else?
I don't have anything else, just to thank you, Derek, for having us on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for standing up for women and for words and reality. Thank you for standing up to reality, which needs standing up for at this point. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Kara Danskin and Ash Chart. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.